I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about personality. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Body language, facial expressions, the way we dress, tone of voice, these are the cues that we use to make snap judgments and how we learn to react in any situation. Our guest, research psychologist Dr. John Mayer, says by beefing up our personal intelligence ability, we can lead our best lives. We're about to present his newest findings. Along with Dr. Peter Salovey, the president of Yale University, our guest co-created one of the most respected international intelligence tests. Personality tests, emotional intelligence tests. Dr. Mayer is clearly trying to zero in on what sets the most successful people apart, how the ability to read ourselves and others realistically and accurately is key. Dr. Mayer is professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire, a key innovator in intelligence research. He lectures worldwide, has written more than 125 scientific articles and books. His new book is called Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. He and Dr. Peter Salovey, president of Yale, and David Caruso were the first to create a test to measure emotional intelligence, as I said. Their work is at the heart of Daniel Goleman's bestseller, Emotional Intelligence. Dr. Mayer, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So when you say your book is called Personal Intelligence, can you describe that for us so we're all starting at the same place?
Sure. Sometimes it helps to begin with a conception of personality. And personality, as I view it, is the global organization of our mental lives. So it includes our motivations and emotions and our ways of thinking and our intelligences and our the ways that we like to express ourselves and our social skills, and finally our self-control. So that's personality on the one hand. And personal intelligence is the intelligence that we use to understand personality, whether it's our own personality or the personality of people who we're encountering for the first time or who we've known and who we care about.
Do you mean, in terms of understanding self, these are the conditions in which I thrive or die, and these work for me, these work against me?
You know, I'm sorry, I just missed the last part of what you said.
In other words, these are the conditions I need to thrive, or these are the conditions that work against me, understanding self.
Yes, I think, one of the parts of the theory that's new is that to understand ourselves, or understanding ourselves and understanding other people, go together. So many of the same skills are involved in both. And yes, we live or die. Modern society is kind of civil, and so maybe we don't have to die if we misunderstand. But it certainly helps if we understand ourselves and others as best we can.
Well, where does that begin? To understand others, must we first understand ourselves?
I think that we begin, you know, I think that from infancy, or if you consider newborns already can perceive faces and recognize facial expressions from an early age, and they recognize parents reflecting their own emotional expressions. So I think that infants start reading personalities even before they perhaps have a sense of self. Of course, we can't ask infants, you know, do you have a sense of self? So that's a little bit of a mystery.
But that raises the question of whether some of this, are we wired for this to some degree? Do we come into the world this way?
I think so. And I think one of the most, a very interesting hypothesis or speculation about this comes from evolutionary psychology and the work of a fellow named Ian Dunbar, who's at Cambridge University. Dunbar argues that one of the reasons that the human brain increased so much at the same time as human beings expanded the size of their groups was in order to read these aspects of personality. Now, specifically, what Dunbar was observing was that in groups of primates, other than human beings, they're limited. They are capped at about 30 individuals. And that's about the number of people who you can see in a day and groom in a day. But human societies, we know from archaeological findings, grew much larger than that. And Dunbar says the reason was humans could keep track of one another by gossiping about one another and what one another were doing. So the capacity to know what other people are doing, to hear about them, to think about that, and to put that together into perhaps models of how they're motivated and what they want to do, I think enabled some of our ancestors to have an adaptive advantage over us.
I was just thinking, the gossip writer Liz Smith must be jumping up and down cheering for you at this minute hearing this. So our brains, in terms of being human beings, our brains grew larger. I think I remember you writing in your book, quite a bit larger because of that need or desire to associate with other people, more people.
Right, and the capacity to kind of manage our expectations of other people. Now, true, this is all speculative. We can't go back. We have, at least with our present levels of technology, we can't go back and see what people were doing. But in a study conducted in my lab, I sent my fellow researchers out and I myself to read all of the earliest written documents across a variety of different cultures in the ancient world.
Yeah, that's interesting to read about. Go ahead.
Yeah, and one of the striking things we found was that across all of those cultures, there was what I'll refer to as a technology of understanding people, advice for how to read other people and to anticipate what they might do. And this occurred in China, in India, in the Middle East, and in ancient Greece. So our earliest written records confirm this, the importance to members of society of being able to understand personality.
There were advisors. This is where these advisors to the kings, the emperors, the rulers in all these ancient societies came from, right? These were the ones who said, were recognized as being particularly good at this, and then that became a valued skill.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. You've told us what you mean by personal intelligence and the difference between that and personality. So why is personal intelligence of such interest to you?
Well, I think, we've had these advice givers throughout history who've told us that it's important to live an examined life, to develop self-knowledge. Other people tell us how to read people. But although there's a lot of lip service paid to this, it's really a very difficult task, I think, for many people, myself included. And what I wanted to do, what I wanted to do ultimately was to try to put together the rules and understand something about the rules about how we do this, and to find out whether perhaps there was an intelligence involved in doing this.
We know from your earliest work that I mentioned, this is the work that Daniel Goleman based his book on. Your work, and I didn't know this. I thought it was Daniel Goleman who'd come up with this, and I was just amazed, and I so respect that you did this work.
Well, thank you. Yes, Peter Salovey and I, who is now president of Yale, and I think I think they're having commencement there today or tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
He and I in the late 1980s began work on an idea that there might be an intelligence that people use to understand emotions and to reason about emotions and to know, for example, that if a person gets angry. And then an hour later is ashamed, to be able to guess what might have happened in between, for example, that the person expressed their anger and then discovered it was misdirected. Maybe she blamed a friend for something the friend hadn't done. And so we put together this theory of emotional intelligence in 1990, and then Dan Goleman had written a book which covered our work and became a very widely known in 1995. And one of the interesting things about Dan's book and the popular accounts was that it often tried to move into personality psychology by saying, well, emotional intelligence involves personality traits like optimism or persistence.
Uh-huh.
And Peter and I knew that wasn't really the theory, that people with emotional intelligence can have any kinds of personalities. But it would have been so great at that time to have a theory of, to broaden that theory to cover all of personality, I thought. But we couldn't do it at that time because not enough was really known about personality.
You're saying that with time, data, if things are so data-driven now with brain scans, we can know so much more than we knew. Although, when I read you saying that, I thought, but it's all a moving target, isn't it?
It is a moving target. But one of the opportunities that Peter and I sensed in the late 80s was that emotions researchers had made a tremendous amount of progress in understanding how emotions worked and what emotions did and how emotions could be defined. And there was a growing acceptance of what emotions meant, their psychological meanings. And so that opened the window for an emotional intelligence at that time. And I've been very excited to see that since 2000, there's been a similar opening of the windows and doors of understanding in the field of personality psychology, so that suddenly there was enough information available to say, okay, here is how people understand one another, and here is how people understand themselves. The time was ripe to see, well, okay, does that broader intelligence about all of personality exist?
This is research psychologist Dr. John Meyer. He is author of the new book, Personal Intelligence, and it's about building skills to understand ourselves and read others accurately for more successful outcomes at home, at work, in your personal relationships, on the job. So how do we do it? We can learn something about this from people who do it well, who seem to have been born with these certain traits and perhaps develop them. So how do we do it?
Well, I think that the people who are... I think that we go through four... phases. I've sort of tried to describe the process as going through. And one is to we start by picking up clues to another person or to ourselves. I think it's simpler to talk about other people for a minute. So we encounter someone and we start looking at clues, expressions that they go through that indicate something about their personalities. That's the first stage. The second stage is we use that information to construct a preliminary model of what they might be like, this person's wearing bright clothes, she's speaking very loudly, she's speaking quickly. I'm going to bet that she's extroverted and outgoing and likes to be around people. So that's my first phase of my model.
Mm-hmm.
Then we use that information to make choices. I'm a shy person and I'm introverted, so I think I only want to spend about 10 minutes with this person, and then I might find them a little bit overwhelming. But they seem friendly, so I will spend 10 minutes with them and talk with them, and then I may have to excuse myself for some reason. On a broader scale, the fourth area is we accumulate these decisions and use them to shape our lives.
And make judgments about... and situations that are new, people in situations that are new. We use those same skills.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take, please, Dr. Meyer, stay where you are. We're author of Personal Intelligence. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. We'll open the phones. You can ask questions about personality, emotional intelligence, its value, perhaps for teachers, for people at work, and then we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime, including right now at WNPR.org. In fact, right now you can see delicious, easy recipes for dinner, value wines, and much more, including the author of our book and a description of what he has done, the author of Personal Intelligence. Click on Programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. For recipes and such, go to foodschmooze.org. Okay, Dr. Meyer, you've said that the four things would be expressions indicating something about the personality you are interacting with.
Right.
You make conclusions based on what you see about what you're going to do. Then you make choices about your conclusion. And then you use these accumulated decisions to apply to news situations. So you've created a kind of library of information for yourself, both intellectual and emotional, I think is what you're saying.
So
yes. How does this fit in with prejudice, for example?
Well, one of the ways I think that it helps is that social psychologists today tell us that we all absorb some prejudices in our lives. And so it's impossible to avoid them. But what we can do is we can not act on them, to recognize that we have them, to say, well, those are prejudices. They are not the way a person might really be, and to move past them. And I think one of the things that personal intelligence encourages us to do is to move past stereotypes about other people and see more about who they really are. Now, as the same social psychologist will tell us, some stereotypes are helpful. Like if I'm pulling into a driveway and my stereotype of there's a five-year-old child there, and my stereotype of a five-year-old is that five-year-old might not know to stand back far enough from my car, that's a really good prejudicial notion to have,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I want to be careful around that child. But as time goes on, as I learn about that child, I may discover that child is very, very, very responsible, and I'll move through those initial impressions to a more a rich understanding of a person.
Yeah, I was thinking about a story described to me recently by a teacher, a professor at Quinnipiac University, Dr. Rose Criello, and she was saying there was a student who was quite religious, and this student's religion dictated a negative emotion about gay people. And after watching a particular film, this student said, "Oh, I have to question everything now. I see that everything I've been taught is not necessarily right. There's a way to apply something like this. And I need to stay open to the possibility that these gay people are like me in many respects." I found this story, but this student's ability to change in the face of this lifelong teaching and the religions that many of us are bound to, remarkable. So this would be an example of someone with high emotional intelligence, wouldn't you say? That kind of flexibility.
Personality qualities might go into that, including an openness to new information, caring about humanity and caring about other people, and a willingness to question beliefs. I'm not as much as I like emotional intelligence and personal intelligence, I don't want to pin all benefits on those.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's a wonderful and remarkable story, and I do think that people who look at individuals and can have the skills to see more about who people really are, that is, who have high personal intelligence, may find it more easy to move into those realms of, oh, this person is different than my simple rules allowed for. I think other people may live in a realm of simple rules about people and maybe may find it more difficult to move into those richer pictures of who a person is.
In terms of reading about how the brain operates over, you know, a fairly long period of time, I was testing out a theory about some people having brains that work in a kind of what I call black and white way. It's this or it's that. That's just the default system for that kind of wiring. And then there were other people who see a million shades of gray. You could even assign people into political parties this way. And so I wonder if how fixed that is. In other words, in understanding your work and how emotional intelligence works, can both kinds of people, if it's fair for me to classify people this way, can both kinds of people benefit from the emotional intelligence you're talking about?
Well, I think that's a hard question for me to answer, because there are many things in an individual's personality that might end up making them seem and or indeed be or look at the world in more black and white terms or this and that terms. And I think it probably goes beyond personal intelligence or emotional intelligence again. I think that, one of the things that's interesting about this intelligence is that whereas in, for example, verbal intelligence and spatial intelligence, there tend to be right and wrong answers, or rather there are a lot of yes no answers. So for example, if we're looking at a question about spatial intelligence, if you rotate this block 90 degrees, do you see that picture? That's a yes-no answer.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as we slide into what I refer to as the hot intelligences, which an intelligence like personal intelligence, we start to need to reason probabilistically, so that it's rare that we can say a person is this way or that way. Rather, what we have to say to ourselves is more on the order of, I think there's a high likelihood that this person is outgoing and extroverted much of the time.
That is so fascinating to me, because it means what you call the hot intelligence. You know, this is where people are giving you information perhaps about yourself, or, you know, talking about other situations and people that make an emotional flare-up. And the fact that you're saying that is the time to resort to reason, to counteract, you know, the emotion, or to blend with the emotion, is very interesting.
It is, and it's a challenge, and it's a challenge to all of us, myself included. Sometimes people tell me things I really don't want to hear, and my first reaction is to be defensive about it, and I think that's common to many people. But I think that when we use our personal intelligence, we have an advantage of being able to move through those first hot reactions, those first defensive reactions or angry reactions, and to puzzle out and say, well, you know what? You just called me controlling. I think, actually, I remember somebody else called me that a year or two ago, and that's two different people who don't know one another, and they both directed that criticism toward me. So maybe that's finding clues about yourself. So if I can overcome that defensive reaction and start thinking rationally about, two people, very different people, would not have the cause to call me the same specific label unless maybe there's some truth to it. Then we can start discovering things about ourselves that may be very, very helpful going forward.
How do you recognize defensive thinking?
That's a really good question. From, I think, two qualities. One is the affect around it. So if somebody responds in angrily to a comment, that's one hallmark, I guess, of defensiveness. Mm-hmm. Or if they respond automatically to it, like, no, that's not possible. If it seems very out of keeping with what's going on. So I often use the example of the person who's shouting, I'm not angry. Well, that's out of keeping with what's the person doing, right? The person shouting. Yeah. I'm not angry. So I guess those are kind of hallmarks of defensiveness. A person's substantial misdescriptions of themselves is often a sign, I find, of defensiveness that's been operating for a while. So if a person tells me that I'm just very friendly and I just want to help people, but they've been annoying lots and lots of people leading up to that disclaimer, that might make me think, this person doesn't seem to really understand their social effect on other people.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we used to call that defensiveness. In this instance, though, and we can still call it defensiveness, but I also regard that as maybe this person has trouble understanding personality. And that's how they've gotten into this spot. It's not that they're necessarily blocking out information. It's they don't know what information about themselves is to accept.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, people are more than happy to give us feedback about ourselves sometimes when we don't want it. It's easy to get lots of feedback, but the question is, what among those pieces of feedback are accurate? Which among those pieces of feedback are accurate and which are useful and which reflect the person who's giving it and their own motivation?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's a complex,
difficult
thing to work through. And usually we're on the phone with a friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Asking, is this right about me?
Can I phone a friend? Well, I was thinking also about people who do have high levels of emotional intelligence interacting with each other, which can also happen in the home or in the workplace. And it's like a New Yorker cartoon. I mean, it's hysterical because, you know, suddenly there's a flare up and one says you're being defensive and the other one says, well, you look judgmental when I said that. I mean, it's so funny. Yeah. The chemical combinations we all make with each other.
Yes, and that's I think then what we need to do is to walk. My favorite example of that is you're stubborn. No, you're stubborn.
Yeah.
I think there what we need to do is to walk away from that a little bit. There's one of the intriguing things about personal intelligence is that it's got embedded in it. I believe the people who are good at this have what I'll call stopping rules. They know sometimes, because it's all probabilistic, so they may miscall, anybody may miscall, but we have a sense of, let's stop here and walk away from this and come back to it when we're not so upset. You know what, we can't get anything. I think when you're an adolescent, if you're psychologically minded, if you love the life of the mind, and you get into an argument with somebody, you might be tempted to stay up all night and try to figure out where the other person is coming from, and they're trying to figure out where you're coming from. And that's a lovely experience, and I wouldn't want to stop anybody from having it. It can be a lovely experience anyway.
Yeah, it's funny.
But there are limits.
I was going to say, John, that you made me think about how people argue about politics or religion, but particularly about politics. You think it's about reason, but really, for many, it's about emotion. And so that staying up all night with another person, trying to, really, truly, not so much to understand as to convince.
Right, and sometimes that can represent a lack of personal intelligence because there's not going to be any way to convince. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I remind myself, and I recognize there are other intelligences and there are other information systems in the world. So there is verbal intelligence and there is perceptual organizational intelligences and spatial intelligences, and those do have right and wrong answers. And there are in some realms of politics, there are right and wrong answers as to whether, you know, as best as people can figure out, there are rising crime rates or declining crime rates, and some people know and some people don't know. And so there's that. So it's important to recognize, I think, that as we're clued into the interpersonal level and to ourselves, that One of the fun things about these intelligences for me is that they all address different sets of information. And as human beings, we have to respect the fact that all that information is out there. And we can, it's almost like the spectrum. We can only see the visible light, but there is the light that's visible to us with one intelligence, but there may be an ultraviolet light that somebody else can see, or a infrared light that still another person is seeing.
I want to ask you about that. This is research psychologist Dr. John Meyer, who's author of the new book, Personal Intelligence, and it's about building skills to understand ourselves and read others accurately, and the whole point being for more successful outcomes or to live your best life. Would you say that people who are hired by political campaigns then, these the people in charge of political messaging, really get this stuff about what to tap into to get others to be convinced, even in spite of the facts?
I'm going to have to duck this one a little bit, just because I follow politics, but you know, we were talking about those spectrums and which light of the spectrum do you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm not very good at politics, and I'm not very good at understanding those political power conversations and so forth. So I'm not sure I'm very qualified to talk about that, as much as interesting as it is.
Yeah, no, you're very gracious. Thank you. I was thinking, you know, what are you thinking when you're watching these outrageous political commercials on television? Do you ever say to yourself, and perhaps you don't, I think you're telling me you don't, you know, oh, I see what they're appealing to there, or that's an emotional appeal more than it is, although it seems to be about the facts. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, as a psychologist, more generally speaking, anecdotal, you know, one vivid case study outweighs a ton of a ton of statistical evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
So I'm certainly sensitive to those moments. But that's not really my forte. Really not my forte.
And only if it worked that way. You know, I wish we, as a group of individuals, had the intelligence level to say, oh, I see how I am being manipulated, you know, no matter what the party. Here's how I'm being manipulated. Wouldn't that be clever? As we look even at ads, you know, there's so many opportunities here. I think that's what you're getting at. How to use your emotional intelligence, your personal intelligence, as you call it, in all of life. So we're going to take a short break. If you would like to ask a question of Dr. John Meyer about personal intelligence, the power of personality, and how it shapes our lives, introverted, extroverted, no matter what you are or where you are in the spectrum, 203-776-WNPR. We'll be right back. Faith Middleton, and I would be delighted if you called us at 203-776-WNPR. I'm in conversation with Dr. John D. Meyer, and he is author of this book, New Personal Intelligence. It's about the power of personality and how it shapes our lives. Also, I'd like to thank our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol, for all that they do. And you can find out about this book at our website and find all kinds of recipes, things for dinner, great wines to drink, whatever you like, products to recommend at WNPR.org. Melissa, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. As I'm listening to the show here, I was thinking about the impact of mindfulness practice and finding out what your personal intelligence is. It seems to me, I work with teenagers, and it seems that there's a lot of disconnect from their own internal world. And I'm wondering whether that, I guess the disconnect and how younger people sometimes are unaware of their own emotional states and their own internal reactions to things, whether you can somehow enhance that with a mindfulness practice and maybe improve relationships.
Melissa, that is a terrific question. Dr. Meyer, what about that? Is that part of the nature of the human brain at that age? And can mindfulness help, do you think?
I think that, I think of personal intelligence as resting on, first of all, a foundational ability of reasoning about information, about personality. And that's one part of it. But the other part of it, which is a lot harder to study but very intriguing, is what I refer to as the hot information part about it. And the hot information is the fact that unlike verbal information, sometimes that can get hot, unlike much mathematical information, personal information can make our blood boil or it can warm our hearts. We are emotionally reactive to it. And I imagine from having been a teenager myself, mm-hmm. that that's part of making it hard to listen to things. Although I think we're also more open at that age. But because we're probably, as teenagers, not as skilled at puzzling through diverse and different kinds of information from different people, and we don't always know who to trust and who not to trust in terms of getting feedback, it takes us longer to puzzle out feedback for ourselves. And mindfulness may be a way of reducing the temperature of that information so that we're more receptive to it.
Interesting. Melissa, thank you so much for the great question.
All right, thank you.
Okay. 203-776-WNPR to talk with me and Dr. Meyer, author of Personal Intelligence. I have said a lot during this conversation about the payoff, but how do we know? What are the advantages to increasing your personal intelligence? How does it benefit us?
Right. I actually, you know, I kind of shy away from the idea of that this leads to success, because I think there are so many different kinds of success that a person can value and can aim toward. And if you're good at one intelligence or another, you can succeed. Well, here I am using the word succeed. Okay, so you can succeed through different paths in life. So you can become a great computer programmer and become very financially successful and be a very friendly person, and you may not need a lot of personal intelligence. I'm kind of interested in the intelligences that we have generally overlooked during the 20th century, and saying, you know, there are intelligences that are being used by novelists when they plot a novel and have the characters interact, and I think that's personal intelligence.
Yeah.
For some novelists, there are abilities to reason that some people are using in the workplace and others aren't, in order to help people get along. And so what are they doing? And let's value these intelligences that we have up until now overlooked.
You've reminded me, I have a friend who has a child with quite serious autism, and that child, as I understand it, has an ability to perceive music and communicate to some degree with music. And I think, well, that is a valuable intelligence for that child and that family.
Right, exactly. I think that we are all, we have a lot more mental abilities than people imagined in the mid-20th century anyway. And as we catalog more of those, we can be fairer to people and recognize more of the strengths that people have and where those strengths come from, and also recognize some of the weaknesses that we have and feel more comfortable about and less defensive about having some of those weaknesses. If I'm right, for example, and we research this, I haven't mentioned it in this program, but we have a new tests of personal intelligence, which I use to find out whether the intelligence actually exists, and it does appear to. But as we use our tests of personal intelligence, we may find out, for example, that people who seem defensive, and that seems to be a kind of a moral weakness, perhaps, that they can't tolerate information about themselves, that it's anything but that, that rather it's their inability to reason, to successfully reason about what information about themselves is valuable to take in and what is not, mm-hmm. or trustworthy to take in, and what information isn't. And that's going to change our perspective on defensiveness a tremendous amount if that turns out to be the case.
And it's not so easy. I mean, it seems complicated to me. A person can then be, as you've described it, defensive because just preceding that, the person heard the information and then became anxious. And then the anxiety causes a kind of defensiveness. So there's a lot to look at here.
Yes, yes. There's probably more than one factor involved. But I suspect, as I look at research on defensiveness, that at least part of it is that some people have a difficulty integrating information and understanding whether it's trustworthy or not. And if you don't know when people are, I'll call it bombarding, maybe that's too strong, but repeatedly giving you feedback and criticisms, and it's hard enough if you know what's trustworthy and what's not and what's useful and what's not in a particular situation. But if you don't know, That kind of criticism or commentary is very, very difficult, I think, to use in any kind of productive way.
So you mentioned this test that you and your colleagues have created. Can I do a question from the test? Because I loved taking this thing. Here's the situation, and then we'll give you some choices. So a person is in a book club, and the person says about the book club, I like the selection of books, my schedule is the same, my activities are the same, but this guy, it turns out, to be attending these book club meetings less and less. Now you have to figure out, what's the most likely reason, this person we don't know, that even though he likes the club, he likes the selection of books, his schedule isn't different, but he's going less and less. What would the reason be? So here are your choices. He's too busy to go anymore. He's enjoying the discussions less and less. He's less energetic and interested in things around him in general. He's harming himself in some way. So what of those things would you guess about this person? Well, the answer is B, he's enjoying the discussion less and less. So talk about why and how you would do a question.
Okay.
For this, like, why that one? And how does that work, in other words?
So that involves some puzzling through of what is a plausible explanation for somebody's, in this case, change in interest level. And because we specify in the item that they're, that nothing has changed in their scheduling, and nothing has changed in their their books. I'm trying to remember the stem of the item,
yeah.
The beginning of the item. That really there's one explanation which is somewhat more plausible than the others. Now, somebody who's heard that question might say, well, you could also explain it in, you know, one of those other alternatives could be correct.
Shades of gray people. Yep.
If perhaps there's some information omitted. And I'm very sympathetic to that, because when I hear test items, I often go, oh, well, I could have written that item better.
Or it could be three of these.
Right, including my own test items. So I think what's helpful for people to know sometimes also about these items is that we need to ask a lot of questions like this and get a lot of a person's answers before we can estimate their personal intelligence. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because every test item provides a combination of signal and noise. And the signal is usually pretty small and the noise is pretty loud. But over many test items, the noise cancels out and we get a pretty clear signal. So another example of a test item that we might ask is actually a simpler one, which is, let's say a woman is likes to spend time with people and is very talkative. Is she also likely to be rather sensitive and easily have her feelings easily hurt, or B, lively and full of energy? And there the answer is B, lively and full of energy, because we know, for example, from research on personality traits, that liveliness and energeticness go together with talkativeness and the desire to be with people. And that's the kind of change that happens from 1990, say, to 2500, to 2005, which enabled us to write items that are keyed to research, answers.
Yeah, interesting. Tommy, Faith Middleton with Dr. Meyer, go ahead.
Hello, Faith?
Yes, go ahead, Tommy.
Yes, first of all, I'm really enjoying the program. Terrific.
Thank you so much.
Yes, listen to you and love it. This is a great subject. It just does not get enough, in my opinion, publicity. It reminds me somewhat of the Daniel Goleman book, Emotional Intelligence, and working with emotional intelligence. I'm wondering whether or not what we're talking about today coincides with that, or whether you distinguish it. Because in listening and identifying this intelligence, how is it that it can be quantified such that persons can receive some type of recognition for it via testing for college, university, graduate school, because it is such an important type of intelligence. And everything I've listened to, I have not been able to discern whether there's an ability to measure this.
Yeah. Well, Tommy, that's a great path to go down. Thank you so much. And if you'll hang up, Dr. Meyer, this is, by the way, Tommy, Daniel Goleman's book is based on the work of our guest and some other people, Dr. Salovey at Yale, for instance. And so how do we get this into tests, and should we?
Well, we have to get it into tests, or otherwise I'm just spinning hot air here. So after I proposed the theory of personal intelligence, which was actually in a journal article in 2008, I proposed it very carefully to ensure that it was a specific and clear enough statement so that it could be measured with test items like the two test items that you and I just related. And what we did, when I say we, I called up a colleague of mine, David Caruso, who's worked with Peter Salovey and myself, and also Abigail Panter, who's a mathematical psychologist down at the University of North Carolina. And they were both willing to spend a couple years, which was very kind of them, to see whether this might exist. And what we did is we wrote about 140 test items that measured about 16 different areas of problem solving related to personality. And we then administered that to several large samples in succession, looking at the performance of the test items. And from that, and the people, and from that we could conclude draw several conclusions about personal intelligence. The first was that people differ in this ability. There were some people who answered almost all the questions perfectly and other people who seemed stumped by a lot of the questions.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, but that's not enough to claim there's an intelligence yet. The second thing that we were able to do, which is more crucial, is to show that people who were good at one area of the test were generally good at all areas of the test. And people who are poor at any area of the test also tended to be less good at all areas of the test. And what that meant was that although these items were very, very different, these areas of reasoning were very, very different, they all clung together.
Ah, there you go. Thank you so much for being on the show and for writing this book. It's a pleasure.
You're very welcome. It's been a delight to be here this afternoon.
Research psychologist Dr. John Meyer, author of Personal Intelligence. I'm Faith Middleton. This show, as always, is about the richness of life. Go to WNPR.org, search programs for all of the information on the show and great recipes and wines.